This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. Almost 3 months after Russia shocked the world by invading Ukraine, its military faces a bogged-down war, the prospect of a bigger NATO, and an opponent buoyed by its wins on and off the battlefield Sunday. Finland decided to seek NATO membership as top diplomats from the Western Alliance met in Berlin. The leaders of the militarily neutral country said the invasion had changed Europe's security landscape, and NATO's chief declared, quote, Ukraine can win this war.
Russia's war in Ukraine is not going as Moscow had planned. They failed to take Kiev. They are pulling back from around Kharkiv. Their major offensive in Donbas has stalled. Russia is not achieving its strategic objectives.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg adding the alliance must continue to give the country military support. Sweden's governing party plans to announce its position on applying to join NATO later Sunday. The two non-aligned Nordic nations becoming part of the alliance would pose an affront to Russian President Vladimir Putin, who has cited NATO's post-Cold War expansion in Eastern Europe as a threat to Russia. NATO says it's a purely defensive alliance. While Moscow lost ground on the diplomatic front, Russian forces were failing to make territorial gains in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine said it was holding off Russian offensive Sunday in the country's east, and Western military officials said the campaign Moscow launched there after its forces failed to seize Kiev, Ukraine's capital, has slowed to a snail's pace. Find more on the story on our website, VOAnews.com, or follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. A Ukrainian band won the Eurovision Song Contest, a clear show of popular support for the group's war-ravaged nation that went beyond music. AP correspondent Charles Day Ledesma reports.
The song Stefania beat 24 other performers in the grand final of the competition. The public vote from home, via text message or the Eurovision app, proved decisive, while Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed the victory. The band's frontman, Oleh Pesyuk, tells a news conference, people can help Ukraine by spreading information, talking this out, reaching out to governments for help. Stefania was penned by Pesyuk as a tribute to his mother, but since Russia's February 24 invasion, it's become an anthem to the motherland, with lyrics that pledge, I'll always find my way home, even if all roads are destroyed. I'm Charles Ledesma.
Rival Libyan officials on Sunday resumed talks in the Egyptian capital, the latest UN-led efforts to agree on constitutional amendments for elections as the North African nation again finds itself at a political impasse. The first round of the talks, also held in Cairo last month, did not achieve a breakthrough in the dispute over the election's legal basis, which was among major challenges that caused planned national elections to fail in December. The failure to hold the vote was a major blow to international efforts to end a decade of chaos in Libya. It has opened a new chapter in its long-running political impasse, with rival governments claiming power after tentative steps towards unity in the past year. Spreading protests across Iran over a cut in state subsidies on food have turned political, with slogans calling for top leaders to step down, according to posts on social media and unconfirmed reports that at least four protesters were killed. Protests began in some cities last week, sparked by the government's subsidy cut decision that caused price hikes in Iran by as much as 300% for a variety of flour-based staples. The government also raised prices on some basic goods, such as cooking oil and dairy products in Iran. Recapping our top story, almost 3 months after Russia shocked the world by invading Ukraine, its military faces a bogged-down war, the prospect of a bigger NATO, and an opponent buoyed by its wins on and off the battlefield Sunday. Finland decided to seek NATO membership as top diplomats from the Western Alliance met in Berlin. The leaders of the military-neutral country said the invasion had changed Europe's security landscape, and NATO's chief declared, quote, Ukraine can win this war. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
May 17th, if no communication has been done to the IMF and the World Bank, we might go back 7 years on that program. So there's a lot at stake, and I think expectations with the general public are high just for reconciliation, but with the rest we expect changes in security, changes in the economic situation.
Somali lawmakers choose a new president in an election Sunday.
On the primary, on the day of the primary, which will be scheduled for one day in the entire nation, let everybody vote. How many people, how many delegates can they buy? So all this nonsense will have been stopped. But INEC will not listen to that argument.
Two aspiring presidential candidates from Nigeria's ruling All Progressives Congress pull out of the primaries of the party.
A justice must see the light of the day. So Fudemo is still going to continue advocating for the release of these MPs with immediate effect, because we are of full conviction that whatsoever that they've been arrested for does not hold water.
And Eswatini civil society and pro-democracy groups demand the release from jail two parliamentarians. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Somali parliamentarians and senators are voting Sunday to choose a new president. The poll had been delayed several times for the last 15 months due to sharp disagreement. The delay, observers say, created tensions in the Horn of African country. This after President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, also known as Farmajo's official term, expired in February 2021. The authorities say 39 presidential candidates have qualified to contest in today's poll. The new president faces significant challenges, including insecurity. For the latest development, I read Samira Gaid in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, via Skype. She is a Somali and regional security analyst.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's afternoon here. It's a little bit after one. The MPs have been streaming into the airport camp today, where there's been strict security protocols in place. MPs and media practitioners and the electoral the team have been heading to the camp. So far, what they've decided is, because the quorum is not yet full, that they would wait for prayers, lunch, and then at 2 sharp begin the process of electing our next president. So the session will probably begin at 2 with prayers, a word from the committee that was preparing the elections, and then we begin the vote.
Samira, how is expectations around the country, especially in the capital Mogadishu, where these parliamentarians will be voting today?
Well, expectations are so high, first, because this has been a very long process. The elections have been 15 months delayed. Secondly, because always whenever we have elections, there's always optimism, hope, there's always change, and people are very optimistic. And then on top of that, you can imagine with election fever, all campaign teams in high gear, it's very upbeat at the moment. But now, at least now, the movement has all moved to the camp. It's no longer in the city. All eyes are on our screens, because access to the camp has been very restricted. So everyone's watching it from their TVs mostly.
Samira, when will Somalis know who their next president is?
Inshallah, how this election goes is the first round that's set to start probably at 2:30, 329 MPs and senators selecting their preferred president. That would probably take 2 hours. First round ends, top four move to the second round. After the top four, then the final to move to a third round. So this process will take approximately 6 hours, and we should know by 9 p.m. Somalia time today, hopefully, who our next president should be.
Samira, some people have complained that there are too many candidates vying to become president. Is that the same concern You are hearing on the ground in Somalia?
Yes, I think it's too much. We have 39 candidates, 3 have conceded. We're now at 36, but even with 36 candidates, they're all particularly coming from one clan. People see it as strategic by others to make sure that one clan's key candidates do not come forth. But it's never a problem. What happens is after the first round, the top 4 make it through, and always the top 4 will be the ones with the most support.
There appears to be, for the last few years, tension between the prime minister and the elected president, which some people say creates some form of tensions among the lawmakers who vote for them, as well as between the president and the prime minister. Any expectations that things will change after this election?
I think constitutionally, the way our constitution is set up, there'll always be that friction. You really need a good working relationship between the two offices, but it depends on the individuals. The president and his former prime minister worked for 3.5 years. I think theirs was smooth, but the first time they dissented on something, which was on the elections, the prime minister was gotten rid of. With the new prime minister, they had a good working relationship until they didn't see eye to eye again on the elections, again on the extension. It was an extension of power that the president had implemented. When they did not see eye to eye on that, then the political wrangling began. So it really depends on the individuals and then on the constitution. It's somehow wired to always have this conflict.
What are the expectations of Somalis after a new president is elected today?
Expectations are so high. I think the first thing is Somalis want to see reconciliation between communities, between clans, between the federal member states and the federal government that are so far apart right now. The country is very polarized. Secondly is the security situation. People are expecting a focus on Al-Shabaab. There have not been any coordinated offensive operations against the group. And the third thing is on economics. The country has really been doing badly economically. The IMF program is set to on May 17th, if no communication has been done to the IMF and the World Bank, we might go back 7 years on that program. So there's a lot at stake, and I think expectations with the general public are high just for reconciliation, but with the rest we expect changes in security, changes in the economic situation.
Samira Gaid is a Somali and regional security analyst. She spoke with me from the Somali capital, Mogadishu. In Nigeria, two aspiring presidential candidates from the ruling All Progressive Congress, or APC, have announced they will pull out of the primaries of the party. Chris Ngige, Minister of Labour and Employment, was the first to withdraw, followed by Benga Olawepu Kashim, a businessman. Their withdrawal came after President Muhammadu Buhari ordered cabinet ministers with presidential ambitions to resign by May 16. The executive order, however, will not impact Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, who recently announced plans to seek the presidency ahead of next year's general election. Political parties in Nigeria are expected to pick presidential candidates by June 3, and the official campaigning begins in September. To become the presidential candidate for the ruling party, Osinbajo will have to defeat fellow aspirants, including APC leader and former Lagos Governor Bola Ahmed Tinubu, Transport Minister Rotimi Amaechi, and Yahya Bello, the Governor of Central Kogi State. For the latest development and analysis, I reach Ogbeni Larry Banjo.
It is absolutely preposterous. If these people are patriotic, if they love the country and the citizens that they want to serve, they should have donated or contributed that money to erect primary schools, to renovate primary schools, to build hospitals, so that they themselves will not need to engage in medical globetrotting. They don't need to come to America anymore. They would not need to come to America anymore. They would not need to go to London anymore.
There are reports of former President Goodluck Jonathan joining the APC and people pressuring him to become a presidential candidate. Some people are saying his candidacy is controversial in itself. There are two different opinions about whether he qualifies legally or he doesn't. What do you make of this?
If you listen to my friend, Mr. Femi Falana, he explained to the nation why he is not qualified. But his position is, the Constitution of Nigeria indicates that one person, a citizen, can only be sworn in twice for a total sum of years of 8. Now, if he had already spent 6 years, if APC succeeded in imposing him, he will only spend 2 years. Then the Bulala oligarchy will come in again, which is their game. Now, let's consider their own position. That, hey, it's not retroactive. Yes, let's say, assume it's not retroactive. We are still falling into the traps of northern oligarchy. If he spends 4 years, they will say he has gone twice. If he has gone twice, then he cannot go again. Northern oligarchy will come in, and Nigeria will be in a deeper problem.
Some people are also suggesting that the opposition PDP itself appears to be divided. They are fighting among themselves. They don't know when their election will be to choose their candidates, their postponement, their legal cases, and all. How is the terrain looking like? It appears there's a lot of confusion going on everywhere.
Yes, if you read your Bible well, if you read your Holy Quran well, I don't know what it says in our own traditional book, if that's one. When human beings were very rebellious to God, God threw confusion into their midst. Now, PDP, in the last election, did not allow any southerners to contest because in their own constitution, it is believed that it is zoned to the north. Now, when we talk of zoning, they look at who is ruling Nigeria now. Now that Atiku did not win, they are saying, well, zoning does not apply now. Zoning does not apply. How fair is that to the southerners in PDP? That is why there is confusion. So when you look at it, it is still the northern oligarchy's game plan.
Let's look at the Electoral Commission itself. It came up with a timetable about organizing elections. What are your thoughts about how the elections will be organized next year? Because the chairperson of the Electoral Commission is confident that the election will be very transparent and credible.
Well, if you look at the previous election, INEC is concerned with if we tamper or tamper with this election, what will the reaction of the people be? And what I prescribe to them is, let every Nigerian register with INEC and indicate I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a PDP, I'm SAA, I'm SAP. On the primary, on the day of the primary, which will be scheduled for one day in the entire nation, let everybody vote. How many delegates can they buy? So all this nonsense will have been stopped. But INEC will not listen to that argument.
Ogbeni Larry Banjo is a Nigerian political analyst. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, the banned political party PODEMO is calling for the unconditional and immediate release of two lawmakers who were denied bail this week. The party says their continued stay in jail is a violation of their fundamental rights to free speech protected by the Constitution. Civil society and pro-democracy activists say the arrest of the two members of parliament appears to be an attempt by authorities to crack down on demands for democratic reforms. Parliamentarians Nduduzi Bakede Mabuza and Mtandeni Dube of Ngwampisi were arrested on July 25th and have been denied bail several times. They were seized by police after their call for democratic reforms in the Southern African Kingdom. For more reaction to the latest bail denial for the two lawmakers, I reached Sibusiso Siyaya, spokesperson for PODEMO in the Eswatini capital, Mbabane.
It is actually true that PODEMO still calls for the immediate release of the members of parliament that were unlawfully arrested within the Tinkuntla regime. You have to understand, Peter, that these are MPs that were representing their constituencies and trying to raise the voice of the people a bit higher to say the time for change has come and our people are completely dissatisfied in terms of the system of governance in our country and are now calling for democratic changes in Swaziland, actually it primarily becomes a struggle for liberation. However, though, today we have actually seen what we have always been expecting, because in our country the judiciary itself has become totally reduced to being non-existent, whereby our people had gone to support the members of parliament with the hope of a bail to be given to our members of parliament, having to go through so many trials, which some of the witnesses of the state have already put their case on the table, but still we're convinced that it does not hold water.
Some people are of the opinion that the court was right in making its decision not to grant bail to the two MPs because the alleged crimes are that serious and that they are treasonable, if you may. How do you respond to that?
As far as we have realized through the trial cases, there is no evidence that is leading or trying to call convincing to say the MPs that have been arrested because of any terrorist action that they have done. But they have just been unlawfully arrested. I think it is clearly to say there is actually someone who is behind their arrest. It was evident even today when it was time to usher out the judgment. There was a moment where judges had to sit and wait whilst the judgment was being looked for, because it was not there. It was so much of a very confusing and shocking a moment, only to be told that today they are definitely being denied a bail despite the application that was already made for their release on bail.
Podemos call for the unconditional release of these two lawmakers. Some of your critics are saying that, why are you asking the same government you accuse of committing acts of illegality to illegally release these people from a judicial process that is ongoing?
Peter, one thing I think that we need to agree on is that the arrest of these MPs was not lawful in itself. It was so of an illegal process, having to consider that the judiciary itself has already been captured within our country, and is captured by the very same ruling elites which we are actually fighting against. We can in fact strongly say that we actually do not have confidence to this judiciary system that we are having in this country. But then that will not stop us from raising our voices high to say justice must see the light of the day. So Podemos is still going to continue advocating for the release of these MPs with immediate effect, because we are of full conviction that whatsoever that they've been arrested for does not hold water, and it has been a proven fact by the state failing to even to bring evidence that is actually leading to say that the three MPs have been guilty of any violent action or action that is illegal or against the law, except that they've been accused on basis of speaking truth to power in representation of their constituents.
Sibosiso Siaya is the spokesperson for Podemos. He spoke with me from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. Construction of the Zambia Fresh Lusaka Market is scheduled to begin in July and will be operational before the end of the year. Officials say it will be a one-stop food hub center being developed in the Zambian capital, Lusaka. It will also be the first of its kind in the Southern African country. Once completed, the market aims to provide a platform for an estimated 3 million local farmers to showcase their fresh produce in what officials say will be in a modern, hygienic and safe trading environment. The produce, they say, must meet international standards to enable the farmers to sell their fresh produce both locally and abroad. The Zambia Fresh Lusaka Market will be constructed by Savenda, short for Save Nations Develop Africa. It's a large Zambian company known for its management of supply chain issues and logistics. Its partners in the UK and US will be funding the new project. For more about the anticipated impact of the market will have on local farmers in Zambia's economy, I reached Clever Mpoha. He is the group CEO of Savenda.
Basically, the market will have the modern facility, the trading platform for horticultural produce, meaning all the vegetables, all the tomatoes, all the green peppers, and things like that, which usually enhancing food safety, food security, and so forth.
How many farmers will this help?
In this particular opportunity or innovation, the Zambia Lusaka market is the first one of its kind that allows 3 million small-scale producers and normal commercial farmers who are in the hundreds to be able to have their produce sold or packaged and sold to all supermarkets locally and abroad, meeting all the traceability from the farm, from the seed to the market, which meets all the international global standards required for produce to be found in global supermarkets. So usually this is our philosophy, basically to say, you know, if we look after our farmers, everybody benefits. And our market infrastructure, operations and trading rules are designed to serve the interests of small-scale producers to ensure they reap the benefits of their hard work. So that means from the seed to input providers, to transporters, to packaging, suppliers, an increase in volume and quality of fresh produce flows benefit through the consumers. And the food, generally the fresh produce varies. So that means the produce becomes available to the supermarket, which is not happening now. As you may have maybe noticed, there are a lot of reports of people crying, you cannot import, for example, like onions. But then the information available, who, which farmer has the onion, is missing. So that missing gap is what we are addressing to ensure that all the products produced in Zambia are available in a clean environment, as our market is going to address, including the fair and the transparent pricing, meaning it is like a stock exchange of fresh produce.
Zambia recently opened the way for farmers of avocado to export to countries abroad and foreign exchange, not only the farmers, but to Zambia's economy. How would this help?
Exactly. So, like I am an avocado farmer myself. I mean, we have a plantation of more than 30,000 avocados. So when time comes for harvesting, this means that you can produce your avocados, make it available to our market. Our market, because it follows the global standards of rules of trade, of making sure that the produce is direct from the source, all the processes up to the consumer. So that means the product can enter international market. As you have seen, the avocados now entering the European market. Because at the end of the day, Zambia has a lot of organically produced food. But they cannot enter the international market because they are not having capacity to trace the product from the source to all the way the processes in between to meet what you call good agricultural practice, including meeting the standards that will allow international global markets to be able to source the produce from the market. So we have an export desk that will take care of all the export requirements, meeting all the international, whether it's European, American markets, to meet all the standard of making products exported. And we offer the storage. And so these facilities will help the small-scale farmer to aggregate their produce into our market, which meets the international rules. And then that product is sourced through the market will be available to any international market. So that makes the benefit of foreign exchange from even a small scale be able to contribute to the national gross domestic, the GDP, through the export. Because now you have more producers of high-quality produce, which meets all the quality rules, and able to trade, and able to be traded through the market and packaged and presented for international market.
Clever Mpoha is the group CEO of Savenda. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, Zimbabwe and the UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, are piloting an effort to avert deforestation and benefit from waste management at the country's biggest refugee camp. The Tongogora camp near Zimbabwe's eastern border with Mozambique has installed machines for refugees to turn animal waste into biogas, which can be used as fuel for cooking and fertilizer. For VOA, Columbus Mavunga reports from Chipinge, Zimbabwe.
Dominic Katumbai, one of the refugees at the Tongogora refugee camp, about 400 kilometers east of Harare, now uses organic fertilizer from animal waste for his plants. He says life has changed for his garden and fields since he started using the product.
Before it was a problem. It was a problem because fertilizer, you buy or whatever. Now this one is free. Every day I can produce more than 300 liters of fertilizer. Now it's easy. Everybody can come and collect and put it in the garden.
The fertilizer is a byproduct from animal waste after it ferments in digesters. The biogas produced during the fermentation is also free to refugees. Some use it for cooking. Francine Kayumba, like Katumbai, is from the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Gas irikunaka because haiti smoke.
She says she's using biogas because it has the advantage of not producing smoke. If you put a pot on a biogas burning stove, she says it stays clean. The Water Sanitation and Hygiene Unit of the UNHCR in Zimbabwe says it started the project after it saw that refugees were struggling to dispose of animal waste at the camp. UA Honda is an associate officer with that unit.
We are now thinking of managing it in a good way, and then we came up with an idea of using the biogas from the piggery as part of the management. And then this year we started the pilot project of this biogas system.
The government hopes to secure more funding to expand the project at the refugee camp, which has about 20,000 people. Here is Johanne Mushanga, Tongogora Refugee Camp Administrator.
The biogas project is a cost-saving initiative meant to ensure that refugees get clean energy. Refugees are also integrated into the modern ways of having fuel or green energy. So to us, it's a shot in the arm for the population.
Zimbabwe says the project will help reduce deforestation near the Tongogora camp. According to officials, Zimbabwe is losing 330,000 hectares of forest annually, some of it through deforestation for energy use. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Chipinge, Zimbabwe.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Recently, the IMF, the World Bank, the FAO, and concerned NGOs have been raising alarm about the consequences of Russia's war in Ukraine for the availability of food supply in the developing countries, particularly in North Africa and some Arab countries, and in the Horn of Africa, where you have had long drought conditions. The reason being that Russia and Ukraine are large exporters of grain to the world, with Ukraine producing large quantities of seed oil and Russia producing large quantities of fertilizers. The absence of these products during the war makes the situation very dire. President Biden last week proposed that one way of dealing with the problem is to get Russia to allow the export of wheat in silos in the Black Sea in Odessa, and this will ease the problem. Frankly, this could not go along with Russia if Russia continues to find it difficult to export its wheat and fertilizers. That is one reason why one commentator last week shouted aloud that sanctions kill. Here we have a moment of full rush in where angels fear to tread. Despite its delicate matter, and it is necessary to bring clarity to the issue of sanctions. Since the UN was established, there have been controversy about UN sanctions. In the 60s and 70s, African states and the allies in the Third World were calling for comprehensive sanctions against South Africa, in particular with respect to the apartheid policy, and Namibia. At that time, Western countries were opposed to comprehensive sanctions on the grounds that sanctions don't work. Later, they changed their position and agreed to apply sanctions on South Africa, and it is believed that these comprehensive sanctions hasten the end of the apartheid system. Now, the Security Council is faced with a problem. Many powerful states and organizations are no longer resorting to the Security Council for sanctions. They are now issuing what are called unilateral sanctions. This too is highly controversial. Countries like Russia, China, and India, and others have declared that unilateral sanctions are illegal. It is true that under the Charter, Article 41 under Chapter 7 allows the Security Council as a provisional measure to issue sanctions. But the Charter is silent as to whether individual states and entities can on their own issue sanctions. This lack of clarity may be understandable because where the Charter wants to be clear, as in Article 2, Section 4, it prohibits states to use force and threats in the conduct of international relations. Be that as it may, the facts are that we are in a situation where sanctions are really ripping havoc on the world community. We have inflation, and because of rising inflation, the two high-producing palm oil exporters, Indonesia and Malaysia, have just banned all export of palm products to the outside world to stabilize prices in their countries. Equally, India, just 2 days ago, banned the export of wheat from India to stabilize prices in India. So then what should one do? Is it possible to find a temporary solution? Of course, the first thing would be to try to end the war in Ukraine as quickly as possible. And in the meantime, it is possible also to work out an arrangement whereby food products could be exempted from Western sanctions against Russia. If this could be done, then the Ukrainians can export their wheat in the silos in the Black Sea without any impediment from Russian vessels, and the Russians could export their own wheat and fertilizer to the world. This solution will help to prevent the pending food crisis in the developing countries, and particularly in Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Life is too short, I know you wait time. When they up at this wire and at the cliff, make you wait time. Who they call me? If you know the party, call me later. If your girlfriend no go go, call your side chick, make the link combo. As I'm on a Samantha movie, and I will go check it. Fine, girls, yeah, what you say, yeah. On your champagne, now, you'll go with where. My guys have a crime in primacy. Yeah, le party, yeah. And then, you see, Javi, yeah. I'm in the Alan, I'm in the M. Only for them, 2:13, I'm going to go to the Alan, I'm in the M. Yeah, let him, 2:17, I'm in the Alan, I'm in the M. Party, party after party, the Alan, I'm in the M.
Enjoy your life because problem is not the finish. Leave me make I chop like man no speaker for English. Brother, I know lady, I work hard for this life. So I go chop on like party your love, eh. Me and me mademoiselle, like Obama and Michelle. We go they do very well, we go they chop on well. Champagne is just for the pain, I'm about to make it rain. I wanna do this again. As you can see, everything perfect. Don't be lying, sweetie, sweetie. Yeah, perfect, perfect. Oh, your baby, oh, la mousse, yeah. Oh, Vicky Naka, Fatou Rankin, and this is the day.
I'm in the land, I'm a death jam. On the bottom of the 2:13, I'm a woke. I'm in the land, I'm a death jam. Baby, come and save for me. My party money or no money. Coming, giving you one of nobody. Who come and join my life for me? Baby, come and save for me. My party money or no money. And he say, it's Mama Minji Diana.
I'll catch up.
What's that? Mama Minji Diana.
I'll
shall read you. No, so Mama Mono Mana. Ah, so nice, Jimmy. You. They give me a couple of me.
You're welcome. Time ballas easy. your policy. Nani kaimba koma, soma, soma. Uye, nani kasema, popo tauripo. Mina kuwaza mama.
When I close my eyes, I see your face. Uzuri wako, I can't compare. Mapenzi ya kweli, kweli ndo nanipa uwe. Sijaona kama uwe Felipe Pita, yeah, yeah. The love that you give me is taking me far away. But you said that he could now be with me.
that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a dog with a bone in its mouth cannot bite you. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.